Well, welcome, everybody. I want to begin by keeping us on discussion mode because I want to respond to some questions and some thoughts that some of you have sent in, and I realize there are a number of you who are from different countries, and the time just does not work to attend live, and I appreciate the responses that some of you have sent in. I want to revisit, so thank you for managing the background noise, and I'll welcome any comments or questions in just a moment. We talked about how simply giving information or facts or data or suggestions, more knowledge, that won't affect change for someone. Now, here's a very simple example of that. We know that from neuroscience, but that's awfully hard since we have been accustomed probably to giving advice most of our lives and just now officially get paid for it. But there are some better ways to do it, and I want to look at some of those with you. Here's an example of that, of why just information and facts don't change someone's mind. An engineer named Dr. Dustin Sandlin was given a bicycle by colleagues that had been welded so that any turn of the handlebar moved the wheel in the opposite direction. It would go exactly opposite of what it should. Well, Sandlin had been riding bikes since he was 6, and he thought he could fairly easily make a shift and ride it. He tried, and he looked like a little kid and felt like a little kid again. It would wobble and fall. He took the bike home, and his colleagues were in on this and helping him illustrate. He took the bike home and practiced every day, sometimes just a few minutes, but every day in his driveway, because he expected to learn in a few days. It took him 8 months of doing it daily. Then later, he tried to ride a normal bike again, but he couldn't do that. The learning curve was much shorter. It was only about, for him, 20 kind of embarrassing minutes. He needed to fully concentrate on this to accomplish it. So this is why simply facts, information, data don't work, because we have to consider it and consider it with open inquiry and look at how we can revise our ways of going about it. So this is where framing becomes really important. A simple example of that is if someone has a limiting assumption. I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel confident. We want to convert it as a coach to looking at a positive framework. Here's the problem. Well, we will say as a coach perhaps, what's the opportunity here? What's the possibility? Because if someone elaborates on the problem, they go down an already existing pathway in their brain, and it etches it just a bit further each time. So we want to reframe it in that way to look at possibilities, at looking at it in a different way. Here's an example of that. For a soccer penalty kick, the kicker is the same 12 yards away, 192-square-foot target. One goalie guards it. When playing not to lose, in other words, the team is down by one and the kicker has to make it to tie, and the team will lose if he misses. So the mindset when he plays not to lose is 62% success. If it's a different mindset, if he's playing to win, that making the goal, they're tied, making the goal will result in a win, the kicker is successful 92% of the time compared to 62% when they're playing not to lose. 30% different. Everything's the same except the mindset. So one application here is when someone has a negative mindset, or let's say this is one of the questions I thought really captured this, that one of you, Sandy Ann. What about negative thought loops and intrusive negative thoughts? Kind of the same thing, that somebody is really burdened by that and keeps on that loop. Well, here's a very simple way, and I'm going to reiterate something we've talked about before. This is self-directed neuroplasticity. Three simple steps. You don't need to go through the roadmap for this. This is what you can do directly with a client. With a negative thought loop, a negative thought in any way, recognize it as an error message from your brain. Well, I can't do this, I don't think. Recognize it immediately as an error message from your brain, because it's hardwired to protect you by retreating or finding some reason not to engage and be embarrassed. So three R's, recognize it as an error message in order to immediately reframe it. What's the challenge or what's the opportunity? Instead of the problem, what's the possibility? And then finally, to refocus on what's the next step, shrink the change to the next step to put that into action. So three steps of self-directed neuroplasticity. Recognize the error message, recognize, reframe to the possibility, and refocus to what's next. So that's one simple way to think about that. And helping someone to reframe in that way may be the beginning of thinking of it in a different way. So any additions or thoughts or questions any of you have while we still are in discussion mode? Or any clarifications? Well, I'll move to lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. If there are any questions or things you want to discuss at the end, I'll reserve just a bit of time at the end. Okay, we talked about the first four steps of the roadmap. And remember, the roadmap is our metaphor, our way of thinking, one way of thinking about a systematic way to help a client craft a story that can address things in a better or a new way, to recognize, to help the client recognize authorship of their story, to own their story, to take ownership of it, to recognize that it's not there until they create it. It's not just happening to them. To assess the plot and the storylines, to assess exactly where somebody is going in a very specific way, and then decide what to change. So our step that we're considering right now is to map a wellness story. So the framing and the mindset of framing things in a particular way, like the soccer penalty kick, will establish a positive mindset to engage something that they want to do instead of foreclosing to look at deciding they can't do it, deciding that they don't have enough experience, wanting to put it off, like procrastination. All the things that occur to someone, the negative thoughts, the mindset, feeling like they can't, all the limiting assumptions, those negative self-talks, every bit of that content is a result of stopping themselves. To look at that dynamic, you're doing something new and different that may be unprecedented, something you haven't quite done before. Even one step into the new and different may simply be taking that step to not stop yourself and try something new and different, even small, will engage a discomfort, a kind of trepidation. So if a client avoids that and has come to automatically avoid that and stop themselves, then all of those negative self-talk, all of the the kinds of things that make it make sense to stop even bargaining with yourself, to procrastinate and say, well, I'll do it next Tuesday. All of those are the result of stopping oneself. They're not the cause. They're the result. The first step is stopping yourself from doing something new and different, because that ends the tension. Kind of like you get ready to jump into the pool to learn to swim for the first time, you have to proceed despite the anxiety, because you can't learn to swim on paper. You can't learn to ride the bike with the different with the opposite handlebars on paper or just in your mind. So if you proceed despite the discomfort, you get to a position of effectiveness and mastery. If you stop yourself and back away, it immediately stops the anxiety. And then there may be reasons that you come up with that you decided not to do it or put it off. That step is crucial. This is where we need to be with our clients and to really get what their experience is of doing something new and different. And think about, this is a total sidebar here, the current book I'm doing research and writing and interviews on is dealing with unprecedented experiences. Now, there's so many small experiences that clients have that they've not had experience dealing with before. I'm looking at some of the major ones to kind of crystallize awareness. If someone has significant success, then they have to deal with things that they've never dealt with before. Success and all of the challenges and stimulation of that, wealth, power, fame, you will be dealing with that with your clients to some degree, because they're going to be more successful than they've ever been before as a result of working with you. So that will be a whole process of understanding and co-creating a way of helping your client make decisions and look at their process in doing that. Because this is going to require, for something that's really different, unprecedented especially, there's no existing models or patterns in their brain to rely on. And intuition, which comes from the unconscious processing and simulation based on all existing models, could even be misleading, because it's using old software. If there's a new situation, old software is not going to be the best kind of information. So just things to think about as you're working with clients. So people will need a system for challenging situations, because that's when they're least likely to make good decisions or to have a system to make decisions, because decisions may be difficult or rare. Sometimes they don't get feedback. They may have trouble translating the situation into understandable terms. Or if they persist in the models that they've used before, the old story, this can make it a bit challenging to engage the change that's required. So, and this is kind of back to the outline. I've departed. I hope I haven't lost you, and these illustrations are helpful. Going back to the outline now, there are six crucial elements that we can think of in terms of mapping change for our clients. And this is a part of a way to further a systematic way to engage the process of what the client is doing and what the client wants to do next. One is to regulate states of mind. States of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determine how we perceive and how we process information and how we respond. We each have many different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, focused attention. Every state has its own software program its own algorithms. Think about a really simple example, creative writing versus editing. Two different parts of the brain. A state of mind to be immersed in creative writing is very different than the focused attention and the intellectual process of editing, the logical brain and the emotional brain. And these two can operate in synthesis, or the emotional brain, if emotion leads the way or is charged, can hijack and hold the logical brain hostage. So one of the most important things that we can do to achieve success and to help our clients achieve success is to help them manage emotions and regulate states of mind. And consider a couple of things that are primary ways to regulate a state of mind: focus and physiology. Physiology is exemplified in the simplest way by a deep breath in for relaxation, breathing out any tension, and doing that even for a minute can really help with grounding and centering. And what we do then to focus, this is our selective attention to look at how we focus from that relaxed, grounded, centered state to consider the options that we need to. Now, for some things, being grounded and centered are not the best way to go about it. If you're in a performance zone and an artist, an athlete, you want to practice in that focused state to develop the automatic patterns and not think about something, but get in that zone and stay there. As a coach, remember we used the analogy of mindfulness meditation. That model with a client to get grounded and centered as a coach and to focus on exactly what the client says and to further that process. And if we get distracted or wonder if we're going to ask the right question, to get focused again on the client, analogous to if you're breathing and you have a thought, you let it go, focus back on your breath. And we do the same to engage the client to look at their experience and to co-create the engagement with what the client wants to focus on and where the client wants to get to. So our brain follows our focus, whether it's positive or negative. So that's why if someone is accustomed to presenting a problem or a negative focus, we may want to redirect what's the possibility here or what's an opportunity. So when a client begins with the problem, I want to understand that, but I will likely want to use that permission that I've been granted by the client, everyone so far, to interrupt and say, you are aware of the problem. Let's look at the possibility here. That's going to be a little harder to look at. So here's one exercise that you might do. I use this with a Vistage group that I did a workshop for, because a couple of the there were 18 people in that Vistage. It's a CEO and business owner mastermind, and they were having trouble because had a couple of one of the people who owned a business had a major happening at his business that was disrupting things. Another, who was CEO of a larger group, had a disruption, and they were both resulting in a death. And they were both still, after two or three months, not able to get on with things, and it was affecting their organization. And here's what they and the group found useful. Every morning, we get up, and first thing we think about is, you know, what's going to happen today? We look at something, and we'll engage something. If there's an abundance of things to be concerned about. Like for these two executives in their companies, that was the first thing you thought about. What bad is going to happen today? What can I do? What, they were preoccupied by this. And that was the framing, like the soccer penalty kick, that determined how they engaged the day, and it was affecting, by contagion, their whole organization and their families. So here's what I suggested that everyone in the group do. Knowing that we ask ourselves questions before we're even fully awake or conscious of it, I suggest that they write down three questions the day before or sometime before they went to bed and asleep that would put them in a peak state, a positive, engaged, positive state of mind. And then first thing when they woke up, before their feet ever hit the floor, they would answer these questions as soon as they turned on their bedside lamp and feel the answer. Just this change and focus to consciously engineer those questions empowered them. And I heard from the chair of the Vistage group at their next meeting, they reported a very positive engagement that went throughout the organizations of the two people who were challenged, and good feedback from others. So this is simply a way to engineer a focus and engineer a mindset. You know, think about it. We do it all the time. When right before you engage with a client, when you log on or receive a call or meet with a client, you get grounded and centered so that you have access to all of your states of mind and all of the information in your states of mind so that you're fully able to be immersed in the engagement with that client. Let me tell you a quick story that I think illustrates it. This is, again, a departure from the outline, but there are a couple of questions that particularly had to do with some examples, and here's an example of an application. Let me tell you the initial story that has to do with self-regulation and mantras. Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived and his team ranked 217th. Out of 217, they were dead last in free shot percentage. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot, a focus like two or three words or just a single word. He suggested something like relaxed and smooth, that they would dribble twice as a cue to have that focus phrase, and at the same time to do a deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out tension. So this was the 3 or 4 second experience before each practice free throw, a cue, like two dribbles, or it could even be a gesture, but dribbles are natural in this setting, a phrase like relaxed and powerful, and a deep breath. So what he also did was to, during practice, blow the whistle, had a player go to the free shot line, shoot two free throws using the mantra, and if they made both, they got a break. If they didn't, the whole team did 4 laps. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide in free shot percentage. So what a mantra does is to generate a cue to boot up that phrase and a deep breath for relaxation and getting grounded and centered. Now, here's a real-life coaching story. You will see if you have a chance, look at the very bottom of the homepage of my website, Mentor Path. At the very bottom is a link to, it's a 30 or 35 minute webinar called Master States of Mind. And it explains this a little bit more and a little bit of the application. But here's a case that was, that helped me create the microsystem that you'll see on the Master States of Mind. A client I'll call Barbara paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions. We were looking at her executive leadership strategies, and she was doing a terrific job, had really been soaring, and she mentioned this was right before the Thanksgiving holiday of that year. And she mentioned that with some embarrassment that she wanted, kind of wondered if we could look at, you know, something really personal for her. That each time, and I said, well, of course, whatever would be most helpful to you. She said every time she goes home to her family, she has the same problem. And this was a very successful woman in her early 50s. And she had a family gathering. It kind of rotated the holiday, but it was once a year. This year, it happened to be on Thanksgiving. Her parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days, and once a year. And she said, basically, I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different, that I won't get into arguments or struggles with my parents and my brother and sister. I can usually last most of the first day. Then something happens, and I just lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family, and it escalates to a fight with all of them, and it ends up the same way every time. He said, is there anything you can do to help me with this? And I responded, I hear how frustrating it is when you want an enjoyable holiday with your family. And she totally agreed with that. And I asked, when you're in the middle of that upset and arguing with them, what's the age of that conversation for you? She knew immediately what I was talking about. That needed no explanation. She said, early teenager. I'm 13, instantly and totally at that time. And I'm stuck there for the rest of the whole visit. And I'll ask her what she was aware of that specifically triggered her reactions. She described, and I asked her to be very specific and very specific about the triggers that she was aware of. She described a particular look from her dad, the way he kind of rolled his eye, a word from her mother, a particular gesture from her brother that would immediately provoke her to feel angry and criticized. So her reactive state of mind instantly transported her to that early 13-year-old time capsule. And all of the responses were in a time capsule. They had not changed since that time. As soon as her state changed, she was immediately in that state of mind, and all the content felt, looked, sounded like when she was 13 and 14 and 15 and on major holidays since then. So I recommended that before we would meet again, and we had, I think, this session and one more session before she had her holiday, I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself to reflect on two things, to make four columns. You'll see this in the Master States of Mind webinar. It's a little more organized than this, but to put on a page three vertical lines, and you have four columns. So column one, list every specific emotional trigger with each family member that she could think of, and do it in a way that she wouldn't trigger herself or get in that state, but do it as an observer. Be objective. Be consistent in being grounded and centered, and look at it as an observer and considering this instead of using that to trigger. And the second column, her reaction to each trigger, the particular look from her dad, or thought, feeling, behavior, if there was negative self-talk, which she had already told me there was. So I suggested that she also, at a different time, at least 24 hours, schedule another brainstorming session with herself and look at two additional things. The third column and the fourth column. Column three, a three-part mantra to get centered and present for each emotional trigger. A cue that she could initiate this process. And she decided the cue, because this would be sometimes sitting in the living room, the family dinner table, she decided her cue was going to be to touch her ring. It was a gesture that would signify to her to get focused, grounded, center, a focus phrase, and she decided to use relaxed and powerful. And the physiology was one deep breath while she was doing that. And the fourth column would be an ideal response. What thoughts, feelings, behaviors would she ideally like to do for each of the triggers? Sometimes it would simply be to not engage. Sometimes it would be to point out her point of view, or simply, you know, I hear your point of view. It was a response or not that would keep her grounded and centered, would be an ideal response. What thoughts, feelings, behaviors, or lack of any of the above for each trigger. It would proactively regulate her state of mind with a new game plan for each situation. So in the next session before her Thanksgiving, she sent me the initial draft of her four columns, and I thought she did really outstanding work. I emphasized the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to quickly recognize the emotional triggers as an observer, column one, and the state change, the instantaneous state change to that time capsule, column two, so that she could use that recognition to use her mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology, column three, to get grounded and centered to engage her pre-planned ideal response, column four, for the emotional trigger. And I emphasize that this is new and different. There's nothing magic about it. It's a hard work miracle. There may be times that you'll have to excuse yourself to go out and take a walk, or simply go to the bathroom and splash water on your face. Do something to get grounded and centered, whatever it takes. You know, sometimes it would simply be going to the kitchen for water. So, in our first session after the holiday, she began the session by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times of challenge, even times when she would excuse herself, even to go for a walk or go to the next room, whatever it took to get grounded and centered, to create the response she wanted. And she was immediately pleased with her work, as I was for her. So to further rewire this new attachment pattern, we reframed each of the previous emotional triggers as recognition of her family member's humanness and of her successful adulthood. She was looking at it, experiencing it from a very different vantage point. She could be even empathically attuned to that 13-year-old who didn't know what to do and just reacted. And she finally said at the end, that was incredible, but it was really hard work. And I said, I hear and I understand how hard and how successfully you work. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. And, of course, she agreed, because this took way less energy than how she had responded before that was very, very draining. So I want to return and sort of just highlight some of the things in your outline, and you'll look at there'll be more of this in the workbook. Secondly, the power is in the focus. How we focus on something determines how we use our energy field and the selective focus in order to understand and as part of self-regulation. And the focus would need to be positive, adaptive. What the positive challenges are, if what you focus on or attend to, you need to focus on something that's positive. This is not positive thinking, but think of it in this way. The focus directs the energy field of your brain, and your unconscious will make whatever you focus on come true. I want to get out of debt. Well, focus is on debt, whether it's negative or positive. The unconscious does not know the difference between negative or positive, just the focus. I want to lose weight. Well, the focus is on weight. And as we touched on before, if the focus is on the body image that you want, what is ideal for you, that's a positive focus. And you can orient what you do and your choices to live into that ideal body image. So here's how Dr. Joseph Murray summarized this. Your subconscious mind does not argue with you. It accepts what your conscious mind decrees. If you say, I can't afford it, your subconscious mind works to make it true. So notice which people worry about illness, talk about pains or disorders. People who are afraid of getting sick are the ones who get sick most of the time. What you worry about happens because you focus on it. So put energy into what you want. Focus on possibilities instead of problems, desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This creates resistance. When you focus on what you want, what you don't want kind of falls away like your lap when you get up to walk. So quantum physics also offers us another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective energy field. Einstein called this a unified field theory. Basically, our mind and bodies are bundles of energy, and focus and interact with the larger energy field. This is how we can read people, focus our choices, determine our flow in the future. So when you're grounded and centered, these are physics terms. When you're grounded and centered, it creates a way to resonate with your true self, to align with your experience, your needs, and your ideals. And this is a question I received and wanted to come back to. When I'm talking about identity, that's a conceptual term, just like we have a concept of story that we're listening for. We're not teaching a story. We're not, doing that for or with a client, but it's our organ. We're not giving a client an exercise of the roadmap system. This is our way of organizing things. One thing that I often do with many clients at the beginning of mentor coaching is to ask them to do the needs and ideals exercise. And I will send them that and ask them to pick the top three needs and the top three ideals that are important to them. And I'll put those inside the folder of a folder that I keep for each client with the client information packet usually and anything that I want to jot down. So that's a way to get the client to collaborate with us to get knowingly, consciously, all of them going in the same direction, to have the needs and ideals clear. And when that's in synchrony with strategies and goals, all of the client is going in the same direction. So these are things simply to think about. Visualizing changes, this can help with people especially who have a representational pattern of visualization. There's an addendum that is in the workbook about the old art and the new science of visualization, to look at how to do that if you want to work with a client in that way, help them to visualize a successful achievement, to experience that fully and to do that systematically. That helps to rewire the brain. And affirmations can be the revision of software that supports the story of the visualization and the brain change. Look at that to see if that says something to you and you think it might be helpful to look at. So the idea about visualizing changes, whenever we do something, whenever we visualize, the prototype study, you know, way back in the day, basketball players at Ohio State were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. One group, 30 minutes of practice daily for 30 days of free throws. Third group, they practiced imagining shooting perfect free throw, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes a day, 24% improvement. The third group, practice by visualization only, 23%. Now, as that's been revised, and there are better ways to create that visualization and that practice, the percentage by visualization only, once given a basic level of skill, surpasses actual practice, because each time you miss with actual practice during that 30 minutes, you have to tweak a little bit because you've slightly grooved it differently in your brain, and you have to repeat the same behavior to groove it. And if it's a perfect free throw, then that has to be repeated. Because once you visualize something and do that repeatedly, it has the same capacity to change your brain than actually repeatedly seeing something through the optic nerve. So here's a focus and visualization exercise, and this is kind of in response to a couple of questions about, you know, say a little bit more about body self and positive body image and weight loss and the comments you made about that. Focus on the weight, and do this for yourself first and see what you think. Focus on the weight that feels good and right for you. Now, as a sidebar, this is not your 19-year-old body. This is your body right now, but ideally as you would like it to be, that's reasonable and the result of diet, exercise, the things that are good for you. Picture what you'll look like at your ideal weight currently. Look at those pictures in your mind every day. Write out your ideal body weight range, not just a single number, because if you hit that number, that's great. It needs to be a range, because that's natural physiology. We vary at 2 or 3 pounds every day, but your ideal body weight range. Focus on the body you want, your ideal weight range, your ideal body image. don't focus on losing weight or wanting to be like somebody else's body. Don't focus on fat thoughts, like slow metabolism or hereditary body size or slow thyroid. Those are all outs, by the way. The spirit of your great Aunt Sally that channeled the curse of large size, focus on the positive. Look at and admire your body. Be grateful. There are studies that show that after a 1 to 2 minute mindfulness meditation, if you end that with focusing on gratitude, that it can notably enhance two significant immunoglobulins that have to do with wellness. Keep in mind the pictures that you have in your head. When you eat, be entirely present to the act of eating and to your body. Each bite, not zoning out after two or three bites, but every bite. And do what's in your best interest. Visualize. And this is a goofy statement, and I'll tell you how I got there. Visualize the thoroughly chewed food assimilated throughout your body. I would ask, back in the day, as a psychiatrist, I was one of the first couple of people in the country that had a multi-specialty eating disorders treatment program. So we had people from all over the world. I learned to ask two questions. I learned to ask, let me give you a prototype instead of it just floating. I would ask a bulimic patient who was in the throes of being caught up in the symptoms of binging and purging. I ask, at what point in the process of using food symptomatically or binging, did you notice that you felt differently? And as you would think about it, it was she, so I'm going to make it simple. She would say, actually, before the food ever touches my lips, 100%. Of the bulimic patients said that. So they recognized that food was a prop in a process, even an unnecessary prop. I also learned to ask, when you eat something, what do you imagine that food is doing in your body as you chew it and assimilate it? In other words, to be consciously aware, not just of the action and the experience of the action, but also of the consequence. We had an American Psychiatric Association award for the highest cure rate, far and away, of other programs in the country, or there weren't any in the world, so I had people from all over at that time. And this was just a simple way. I didn't know all this stuff then. I didn't know a lot of stuff then, but I could get real simple real fast, as you might guess. So think about, as you look at applying this, I want to reserve just a few times. Here's a couple of you have heard this story before about a visualization and how visualization crystallizes possibility into specific ideas, and that experience can change the brain. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was in prison, he was isolated and had no physical activity. And before the war, and before he was captured, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was triple digits. But he decided, in order not to go crazy, he would spend every day, he was in his cell 23 hours a day, he decided that he would go golfing in his mind every day. So he would get up, imagine dressing driving to his favorite course, getting out, warming up, smelling the flowers, having each shot, and then walking to the next. So he would play golf in his mind about 7 hours every day, 7 days a week. In his initial outing, once he was released, he shot a 74. And that's the power of a vision. So another principle that I want to just briefly touch on, insight changes the brain. At the moment of insight, an aha experience for our client, a complex set of new neural connections can be created. When looking at the brain on an fMRI scan, the moment of insight, three different parts of the brain light up, and that vaults someone into a more synthetic, a more creative, and engaged state. When someone is given facts, data, information, no part of the brain lights up. So, as important as this insight-induced change is, it's the sustained attention and the systematic approach that can successfully hardwire it. Five, you got to take action. If Vincent Van Gogh put it this way, if you hear a voice say, "I'm not a painter," then by all means paint. Then that voice will be silenced. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze, plan, think, organize, or important, payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep it moving forward, learn from mistakes, and produce results. That's why you guys are listening to me. You have a growth mindset, and you're looking at what you can do to enhance your growth and the growth of your clients, and maybe apply to others as well. So the most important thing about a goal is having one, creating a system to get there, and the most important thing superordinate to that and more specific at the same time is to have a plan and stick to it. Remember, we talked earlier, you do not need to be motivated. That can be an out. Well, I need to get motivated before I can work out. No, you just need a plan to stick to it. You do not need motivation. That can be a limiting assumption. I'll set up an exercise program when I get really motivated to do it. Wisdom is to know the right path. Integrity is to take it. Another identity transformation, a new experience or idea needs to be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention and focus is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized. Then that new experience is incorporated and integrated into a part of an organized operating system, an evolving self. It's a part of one's identity. So what this means is when your client takes a step into the new, the different, the unknown, and successfully navigates that, you want to highlight that. And this is what helps a client incorporate at a conceptual as well as experiential level doing something new and different. This is now part of an identity. Because, and we'll talk more in our next seminar about this specifically, but identity is one, it is probably the most powerful force of the human psyche. If you do something that's different and you don't incorporate that as part of your identity, but just a piece of behavior that you'll revert back to your identity. We'll talk about that and how to systematically address that with clients in our final seminar next time. So, a summary, and this is in the outline. A summary of these four steps: decide what to change and map the changes. since old patterns are hardwired, it takes consistency of focus on new experiences to begin to change this wiring. Concentrate on new behaviors, not on problems, in order to create new brain pathways. Simply identifying the problem won't solve it. Focusing on problems will go down the same pathway that's already there, just etching it further. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits to begin to create a new map. Regulate states of mind and manage emotion to promote this process. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. Way too oversimplified, but it's a principle. Facilitate insight rather than give advice or information. Have I said that enough? Is that enough information? When diverted to an old feeling or behavior, redirect an idea and energy to new ideas, to the possibilities instead of the problems. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or negative thoughts or non-performance. Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress instead of giving attention to negative behavior. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. A client says, well, you know, I feel stuck. One question is, what would we notice you doing that would indicate what you want? And if we don't see anything together as we're looking at it, then what would be the first step to give you some traction to do that? And finally, think about your new experience and evolving self, how your new experiences require thinking about yourself and your client thinking about themselves and identity in an evolving way. This is no longer the old story. You're in the present moment, creating an awareness of thought, feeling, experience, and recognizing in the client with you. It's not there until you create it. If you go back to the default mode, yeah, that's there. Those algorithms are there, but they can inform us about what to keep, what to let go, what to enhance. Those three questions that we may want to think about as a coach. So putting it very simply, what coaching is about. Are you ready? If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. I'm going to put us, I thought we'd have more time, and I apologize, on discussion. Is there anything else that would be helpful to talk about or any questions that or clarifications that you have that you'd like us to discuss briefly? I really appreciate the questions and the comments that many of you have sent in. I welcome anything. Think about where you are. Write down your most important takeaway from this session, and we'll pick up right here next time. Look at what else you want to focus on and anything you want to address that we haven't so far, or clarification, look at the outline and look at where we're going to bring this together next time. And if there are things that you still want to talk about, let me know. Send me an email, or I'll have an open discussion time at the beginning of next seminar. I want you to really make this yours and get the most out for what you want from it. And I'll review the answers to those questions that many of you have sent in, and I appreciate that. So take good care of yourselves, and look forward to picking up right here next time. Fire off any emails, questions, comments, clarifications that might be helpful, and I promise to work them in to our discussion. Until next week, thank you all very much. See you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Thank you.